Hello, Narnie Webbers. This is Glumpuddle.
And I'm Rillian. Hello.
And we're reading C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
That's real water, that. I'm not sure that it isn't going to kill me, but it is the death I would have chosen if I'd known about it till now. What do you mean? Asked Edmund. It's like light more than anything else, said Caspian. That is what it is, said Rippercheep. Drinkable light. We must be very near the end of the world now.
We've reached the end.
The end of the world.
The beginning. This is the beginning of the end of the
world.
And
just
in
time
fact.
For Christmas.
Woo!
Where
all
it is
right.
snowing, where I am.
Yeah, it's not snowing where I am.
And I am
at
drinking
all.
Hot chocolate.
And I am drinking cold chocolate milk. So.
And Merry Christmas to you, Glumpuddle.
Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas to our other friends in the Narnie Web community. Real quick, name one item you think you suspect that Father Christmas is bringing you for Christmas.
I have no idea. A newly printed copy of the Narnie books in publication order.
Ooh.
I'll take that. Or the announcement that HarperCollins is changing the order back. I'll take that for Christmas.
Well, I am perfect. My spirit is fully fulfilled by the books as I have them all memorized, of course. So I suspect I am getting the complete hardcover Calvin and Hobbes collection. Not sure, but I think I might be getting that. So
you'll, oh, please, I'm sure everybody's on the edge of their seat. So please report back on our next
it'll
episode.
It'll be the next special. It'll be episode 100. We'll be about
episode
the Calvin 100. And Hobbes edition.
Yes, that'll be our featured story, of course, is whether or not Rillian got what he thought he was going to get.
Well, tonight we have four insane chapters.
Four of the weirdest chapters.
I don't like calling them weird. Because they're some of my favorites.
I'll call them weird.
You'll call them weird. I'm going to call them mystical in the traditional sense of the word.
Sure. Mystical. I'm also weirded out though, but
really?
In a really great, but okay. in a really great way that kind of expands the imagination and makes me long for the world's end.
Does
we've got another really creepy scene? I think you were talking about this towards the end of the last one about the three sleepers, which they soon find out are the Lord Drevilian, Argos, and Mavrimor, and so they've essentially completed their quest.
It's really the final island.
Yeah, they've located. The last of the three lords, and they're all asleep, and their hair is really long, which is weird.
There's this huge banquet with no explanation for it, and I just have to say something. You know, just this whole scene that I realized this as I was going through the book again today before this is Lewis was so. I mean, we've talked about this before. He kind of ups the ante a little bit, like with each island. It's just a little more weird, and it's not like it's not like every island is a I might die situation.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's more a little more scary than that sometimes, more mysterious.
More mystery is what you said. Yeah, I said each island gets more weirder, which it does, and you said it gets more mysterious,
and
which it also
helped
does.
Me realize, you know, it's something that I realized with some of the filmmakers. I thought, you know, these people read all the wrong books. When you think about what they had to do for challenges and things like that, you read this, and even other books today, sometimes I think a lot of these people are reading the wrong books, and they're writing stuff that's just kind of pedestrian and cliche. I mean, this is just so interesting. Where does this come from?
Well, this stuff is so, like, it's so weird. I just read it, and my first thought is, man, you can't make this stuff up.
Exactly.
And I realize,
he did,
wait a minute.
But it's like, he had to have made it up.
Or did he? Or did he? You see, that was my first thought is, oh, you can't make this stuff up. I'm like, or did he? And of course, we talk about all the little subtle ways, which I'll talk about a few more in this episode, of ways that Lewis just gives you the sense that, as crazy as it is, maybe this somehow really happened. But you were talking about how they assumed the food was evil before we started recording, how you thought that was interesting.
Sometimes you have the classic, you know, guys, you know, walking into a room with a scary room and the reader or the viewer is going, don't go in there, you know. Then you have the next level where you have a character going into that room and someone else is going, don't go in there, which is what you think this is going to be. Like, no, because the reader's going, of course this is why they're asleep.
You think they're going to eat the
food,
but no, they're
Lewis
actually
just
smart.
Turns that on his head saying, But you have no evidence whatsoever that this is what caused him to sleep. You're just assuming that. And the reader's right. going, well, yeah, I guess I am. But you know, uh-huh. it turns out to be completely false.
Well, but it makes perfect sense, especially there's a really great, interesting character moment with Edmund later, where when he meets Romandy's daughter, and she seems so beautiful, and Edmund is the one who says, you know, you seem so nice, but how can we know that you're a friend, Edmund of all people, after the White Witch Turkish Delight fiasco right. would be the most skeptical of them all. And I think that's a similar thing happening here, where, okay, if this seems so awesome, okay, what's the catch? What's going on yeah. here?
No, it's great. I think that it takes a lot of little assumptions that you might predict it's going, and it just kind of turns it on its head.
Yeah. There's a nice little human detail, the fact that they have to take the time to choose their seats. They're going to spend the night with these creepy creepy haystacks of people, as they described them. And they say, like, well, should we sit across from them? And, of course, they talk about, you know, once the light goes, they won't be able to see them. They won't be able to see if they're moving around or anything. And without having to develop them a whole lot more, just the fact that he says they had to really think about where to sit, because they were creeped out by these guys. Like, wow, I really relate to that. So
yeah.
even though I immediately go, wow, these are real people. But you mentioned the stone knife before. And why do you think Lewis has the stone knife here? It's not like it's... If it wasn't there, no one would ever say, where was the stone knife? Mm-hmm. You know, like, why did Lewis say, hey, let's put the stone knife here?
The Remender's daughter says, that is what threw the three men into his sleep, because it's a thing not for him to touch.
And it was brought to the table to be kept here in honor.
I think that and who the brought way it that there, I think of this, because this is the last place before the end, or the beginning of the end, I think this is a resting place. This is a place where Lord Roop can get the sleep he needs. This is a place where someone famished can come and find rest. And because it's a place of rest, why would a knife be here? It seems kind of counterintuitive. But in some ways, if this is a place of rest, it's the best place for this knife, because then the knife will never be used again.
I don't know. I've thought about this for a while as well, and obviously it would be a very significant artifact if this is the knife that's actually pierced Aslan's skin, and we've seen how powerful Aslan is and how seemingly limitless he is and all-knowing, how he's able to take different forms, and the fact that this is the knife that actually killed him, wow, it does make it kind of a significant artifact. But why Lewis decided to have it here, and... I guess a really more interesting question to me is, how did the knife get there? It was brought there. Why? Who brought it there? Who said, it there to be kept in high honor? And
yeah.
I don't understand. This all seems like a lot of things, especially Narnia, especially this part of this book, seem like cop-outs when I'm talking about them. Like, well, why is it so interesting? Oh, it's because of all the things Lewis doesn't tell us. But that's easy. Any author can just write a story and choose not to tell you things, you know, and that doesn't automatically make it interesting. What is it about this that makes him so intriguing? Like I said, Lewis doesn't give you a lot of details, but the details he does give you just get my imagination going. And like this one,
what is the point
suggests
of this,
backstory
this
to me.
What?
Why was it brought there?
The knife.
If anyone listening has any ideas for why you think Lewis decided to include the stone knife, it's not a bad thing. I think it's a really intriguing thing. But why would it first – he's sitting there, you know, writing away, I think I'll put the stone knife here. Why did that thought even come to him? I'm not really sure. It's very interesting, though. So they are Romandu's daughter comes out and corrects them and tells them it's not the food that brought them into this sleep, and that the food is renewed, in fact, all the time for travelers who come so far, which always made me wonder, well, who else has come? I guess other people, presumably at some point, have made this journey. Who they were and why and how far they got? Another interesting question that suggests backstory.
What do you think about Romandu and his daughter just being stars and then the daughter of a star?
Romandu is a star at rest. So when he was brought there... And he was really, really old, and now he's, you know, every day a bird or whoever brings him a fire berry, and he gets a day younger. And eventually, when he's as young as the child that was born yesterday, he's going to go back and be a star again. One of the most interesting ideas in the series. Of course, it makes you look at all the other stars in Narnia, and you kind of go, man, so each one of them has a story. Even one of the stars has a story. So I've always loved the fact that in Narnia, stars are alive. I've always found that interesting.
I love this part. This part sticks with me just because of one line. where, and I think I was maybe in my late teens, early 20s, when I started to grasp the meaning of Ramandu's line to Eustace, because Eustace at one point says, well, in our world, a star is a ball of flaming gas. Mm-hmm. And he says, even in your world, that is not what a star is, but only what a star is made of. And for a mm-hmm. long time, I thought, I don't understand what he's saying. I really didn't understand it at all. And it's interesting, you know, Lewis even wrote a book about the mythology of the heavens, of the seven planets. And it was interesting because people were kind of getting down on him saying, but this is, you know, medieval cosmology. This was, you know, years ago. We know that this isn't how they operate now. And he says, I know that's not how they operate, but that doesn't mean that there's not beauty in what the people thought they represented, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, for instance, you know, just you look at a human, you know, Lewis understood what a human is and what a human is made of is are two very different things.
What was the stone table made of? It was made of stone, and that's it. But what was the stone table? It's not just a piece of stone. It represents this law of the deep magic.
It was all the, so the,
it,
that
it
just
means something
my
more
once
than
I
what it's made
to understand
of.
Understand what Lewis was saying, just in that one line. I mean, it seems so simple, but that one line can be applied to so many things throughout the Chronicles and throughout
in
life.
So many ways.
Mm-hmm. That moment sticks with me so much just because of that one little lesson that what something is can't be quantified materially.
And even I think you could even apply that to when people look down on fairy tales and say, or even just storytelling. It's, oh yeah, it's just story, it's just fairy tales. And it's like, no, that's what it's made of, but what it is something deeper. To Voyage of the Dawn Treader or all the Narnia stories, or Voyage of the Dawn Treader may just be a fairy tale, a story. It never happened, presumably. But that's
good.
What
I
it's gonna, made
I
of.
I was about to kick you off the podcast forever.
It's like, that's what it's made of. But what is it? It's a story about the belief that this desire to experience something beyond the world, this desire for this world to not be all that there is. That's what Dawn Treader is, even if it's not what it's made
yeah.
of. So, I guess this is as good a place as any to discuss Caspian and Ramandu's daughter. Ramandu's daughter, who unfortunately is never named.
The Caspian's whole little segment here, this whole portion. You know, yes, he's brave and he's kind of a leading man in the story, but he's clever. You know, we saw that on the Lone Islands. We see it here, where the men are trying to back out, and Caspian says, you know, we don't come to you hat in hand. And it really is a great moment from there. And then, in the same chapter, there's a point where, even now, even though, you know, I like this story and everything, I love it, this story and everything, I kind of giggle a little bit where the, Lewis does this great, again, kind of turns things on its head, and, you know, Caspian says, you know, the world my friends come from, the enchantment cannot be broken until he kisses the princess, you know, nod, nod, mm-hmm. wink, wink, hint, hint, and then she says, well, here it is different, you cannot kiss the princess until you've broken the enchantment, and he says, well, then tell me how can I can break the enchantment at once. I'm thinking,
tell me how I can do it.
Okay, so he really likes this girl. And
So they're kind of speaking to each other in riddles a little bit. See, I really like it. I think that it's really the way that you figure out that, okay, there's some kind of an attraction here is when they're talking about the fairy tale. First off, they're talking about how do we break the enchantment of the seven lords? And she said, and he basically says, you know, you can't. It's the opposite of the fairy tale from their world. If you have to break the enchantment, then you have to break the enchantment, then you can kiss the princess. And so I think the fact that Lewis doesn't come out and say it, that he does force us to kind of infer it and read between the lines a little bit, I think helps quite a bit. And so it's kind of cleverly done. It's not in your face. I think that helps quite a bit. And also, this is a story about, first off, constantly suggesting backstory, constantly suggesting something that's not necessarily presented to us. We have to kind of read between the lines and say, wow, there's more going on here. And I think that's what's happening here. When the infamous Dawn Treader leaked script hit the internet, which, you know, the script for the movie, which came out in a couple of years before the movie came out, and most of it's garbage.
I'm giving more airtime to this, but go on.
But no, I actually have something semi-positive to say about it here. because when it first came, I'm sorry, I should not have said that as you were. Sorry for saying that as you were taking a sip of hot cocoa. Hope you didn't burn yourself. But so when I was reading the leaked script, it's mostly garbage. But there's this really cheesy kind of subplot of Caspian having dreams about this star girl, I think they call her, throughout the movie, which of course turns out to be Romania's daughter. The way it's done in the script comes across as really cheesy, but I remember when I first read it, I didn't hate it nearly as much as I kind of thought I should, nearly as much as other people were. I kept thinking, you know, this is cheesy, but the idea of him having some sense of Romania's daughter beforehand doesn't bother me that much. And I really kind of thought about it, and somehow the sense of I felt like in the back of my mind, I'd always sensed that, you know, there was something with Caspian going on that we didn't necessarily know about. And I just, I'm kind of listening to myself right now, and I feel like someone's going to listen and say, what a cop-out. Basically, Lewis has a super thrown in there at the end, underdeveloped romance, and what's your justification for it? It's so interesting how little he tells us about it, and that's not the all-purpose excuse for underdeveloped characters. All I can say is that the world that Lewis has created of so cleverly always giving you the sense there's something more there, and the fact that it's a story about the belief that my destiny lies somewhere else, that there's something else out there, gives me the sense that I think there's something more to this than we know, that maybe Caspian has been experiencing something, maybe a longing, or maybe he has been dreaming about this star girl, like in the leaked script, I don't know.
And that's really a great transition into Reepy Cheep and his speech here, and you kind of said it. He said it was really, I think, did you say it was the best speech in the whole, all seven books?
Oh, yeah, the Reaper Chief, his belief that there's something else out there. And I would like you to read the speech, because they're trying to convince the crew to come along with them to the World's End, which is something I'd like to talk about in a second. But Reaper Chief is notably silent, just like he is in Deathwater for most of it, actually. He's just silent. And finally they say, well, what about you, Reaper Chief? What do you think, you know, about going to the World's End?
Aren't you going to say anything, Reap? Whispered Lucy. No. Why should your majesty expect it? Answered Reaper Cheep in a voice that most people heard. My own plans are made. While I can, I sail east in the Dawn Treader. When she fails me, I paddle east in my coracle. When she sinks, I shall swim east with my four paws, and when I can swim no longer, if I have not reached Aslan's country, or shot over the edge of the world in some vast cataract, I shall sink with my nose to the sunrise, and Peepy Cheek will be head of the Talking Mice in Narnia.
That speech is so awesome. As a geek, I just have to correct you that it is, you make the mistake that almost everyone, including Derek Jacobi, makes. You read it on tape. It's Peepy Keek.
Peepy Keek.
Everyone always says Peepy Cheek. It's Peepy Keek.
I know. I saw that as I read it. I thought, I'm just going to say it because
I think the audio drama, it's a stupid little detail. It doesn't matter.
Is
but
it
the audio
is
drama
it
gets it wrong.
Because I would say Peepy Seek before Peepy Keek.
I think Peepy Keek makes more sense.
You know what I love about this? If anyone else said it, it would just sound ridiculous. But it doesn't sound silly or odd at all coming from Reepy Cheep, because you know it's completely accurate.
Speech is awesome.
I mean, it's just a fact. He's not trying to brag. He's not using some lofty language to get a point across. It's just that is exactly what he would do.
And it's just his absolute fearlessness of the World's End, which is kind of scary, as we'll get into. Going to the World's End is not just, oh, that'd be awesome and wonderful. No, it's scary. The World's End, what might you find if you go over the edge? What might be at the bottom?
Exactly. I saw parts of the Caribbean.
Oh, there. Then we know what it looks like. Okay.
No, like you're saying, you know what?
But
thing
he's
I love,
just absolutely like,
going
no,
to the today,
that's where I'm going. He's hell-bent.
Even going
to
the
he
book
doesn't
today,
care.
Ramanda's daughter says, you must leave one of your company behind. And I, even now, even after
desire.
Having read it, I don't know how many times, my first thought is, oh, leaving someone behind? What a sacrifice. And PBG, oh, great. Reepy Cheep instantly says, that is my heart's desire. And it's just...
That's true. I suppose the notion of having to leave someone behind is essentially supposed to be like a sacrifice.
Yeah.
But for Reepy Cheep, it's like, yes. And of course, here's where the two... kind of main ideas of the, you know, the whole main kind of plots of the book of, you know, yes, it's the seven lords, but it's also this hope of getting to Aslan's country ultimately comes together, and there's an elegance to that. But why do you think there's even a need for him to deliver this awesome line, though? And by that I mean Lewis kind of introduces this conflict all of a sudden of having to convince the crew to actually come to the world's end. So there's actually a possibility that some are going to say, maybe even most of them are going to say, no, that's it. We should just turn around and leave. I think the main thing it does is I love the fact that, yes, the crew did agree to go on to set sail and seek the Seven Lords and avenge them if they could. And I think it's pretty clear that this does fall under that. That they couldn't just turn, well, we found them. They'll be asleep forever, whatever. We found them. I think it's pretty obvious. No, it's essentially what you agreed to do, to go to the world's end, leave someone there to wake them up. But even Caspian's like, okay, I know that's what they agreed to, but the world's end? How could anyone have really understood? Well, like that's just so big. I can't, even though it's, I think it's technically what they agreed to, I can't make them go any further without asking them again, do you dare to go to the world's end? And I think that's the main thing. And I also think that it really gives, Lewis is emphasizing that the world's end, that's a dangerous idea. That's a dangerous place because you could find absolutely anything. And that's, I think Ripachit feels that fear and he loves it and he thrives on it. Of finding the fear, the awe of the unknown is such an important part of this book. So I think those are the main things it does.
I think it, yeah, the way it's done here, it's not just kind of a clarification of reminding the audience, oh yes, this is a big deal. It's actually, it kind of puts the audience in the place of those crew members. At least that's how I felt as a reader. I'm kind of thinking,
I wonder if I would have the guts to actually go.
I could see myself, you know, really wanting to. And then, of course, you think to yourself, oh, I would hate to be the one crew member left behind. I would hate it. You know, this kind of puts you
cream,
in his shoes.
The one crew member who didn't go, Pitt and Cream. And I kind of wonder, yeah, as much as we think, wow, this is so amazing, if I was there, would I actually have the guts to step on board that ship and go to the world's end, having no idea what we're going to find, if we even can get back? I don't know. And I just think it's good to acknowledge that this is a really awe-inspiring, scary thing, as amazing as it is. I think if Lewis just did, oh, amazing, world's end, awesome, it might still be a semi-interesting read, but I think the fact that he acknowledges the danger and the awe and the fear of it is what makes Dawn Treader so special to me. It makes it a much more powerful emotional experience. But they get going. They leave Romandu's Island. And basically the next chapter is like this weird, dreamy montage of so many things.
Yeah, you have
that,
the mer people, which I really like because I'm always interested in just
Lucy seeing the shadow of the Dawn Treader.
Yeah, well, but not just that. Just like, you know, because you have the people that Narni interacts with. You have the Kalormans and you have Arkenland. But then you have a whole other world that no one has ever, presumably, spoken to.
Well, yeah, it's just funny. We always think of the World's End as this thing that no one's ever been before, this mysterious thing.
There's
actually a thriving
kingdom,
race of people there.
Yeah. So I like that. And it's interesting how, again, it just, I always thought it was fascinating how the sun just gets so much brighter.
Uh-huh.
As they get closer, it bothers them less and less, and they end up thriving on it, and they don't need to eat as much.
Uh-huh.
Remember that moment
when they're still on Romandu's Island and the sun comes up. You know, apparently Edmund later said that although there were moments on the voyage that seemed more exciting than that, that was really the most exciting moment of all. Which is quite a bold claim when you think about all the weird stuff they've encountered. But the moment the sun came up, that was actually the most amazing. Which just seems like such a great, again, it makes you feel like it really happened. Like, I know reading the book, it sounds like that's not the most amazing, but if you'd have been there, then you would understand.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that books alone can do, because they can just state
it's impossible
that.
To imagine a film capturing even half of this. There's so many things in here that, again, I don't know how Lewis makes it so intriguing. It doesn't seem like, what? A cop-out? Like Lucy sees that one girl in the water, and they see each other for a moment, and for some reason, in that one moment, they become friends, and Lewis writes that if they ever see each other again, they'll rush to each other with their arms outstretched. I don't understand why all these things are in here, unnecessarily. There's all these weird things, but it's just, it's a lot like the end of, which I know this was made after Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but the end of 2001 A Space Odyssey, which we have very different views on, I know.
One of the best. Everyone needs to watch that film so they know what drugs do to the brain.
Everyone needs to watch that film so they can see a beautiful, absolutely beautiful, film about...
LSD is a terrible, terrible thing.
No, it is a film about exactly what Voyage of the Dawn Treader is about. That's the longing for, like why does the space race capture our imagination so much? And what, you know, because we're hoping deep down that we'll find something else that's not just us. That just, and why that captures our imaginations. And this astronaut, to sort of spoil it, I guess, but he gets there and he's experiencing things that you can't even, the human brain can't even comprehend. And I think that's what we're seeing here at the end of Voyage of the Dawn Treader is, like, Lucy having that experience with that girl. And why were they suddenly friends all of a sudden? And things like how they saw mountains but couldn't see the top of them, and they don't remember ever seeing any sky in that direction. What? You know, there's no way you can even begin to visualize that. You can sort of get a weird version of it in your head, I guess, but you can't really nail it down. And it's sort of like, what would you expect? You go to the world's end, and whatever's there, whatever is sort of beyond our world, beyond our comprehension, that's all it can be, just beyond our ability to comprehend. And that gets me excited. And I think it'll certainly get Reepicheep excited as well.
You know, the reader is just trying to think, wait a minute, the world ends. Wait, the world ends. Because we don't have a category in our brain for that, you know. And it's not even the, oh yeah, it's like a table with the ocean continuously spilling. It's not even that, you know. It's the opposite, with the water going up.
I think it takes a lot of courage as an author to write this stuff, and just to things that don't necessarily make sense. And you get the sense that Lewis is writing things that actually happened, and he can't just choose not to write it down because it doesn't make sense. It's like, well, it actually happened, so I guess I have to do it. That's the sense you get, and he gives it the sense of reality and wonder. There's a one bit here that I think is probably the most interesting in terms of the character of the narrator. You know, we always get the sense reading these books that there's someone actually writing this down, and that maybe they really happened. But then maybe you could have read between the lines and gotten the sense that, did these characters actually exist and Lewis actually talked to them and is writing it down? Maybe. There's a bit here where he basically comes out and says that. And that's a bit where they hear this, they hear this sound coming from the east. And Lewis writes, "It brought both a smell and a sound, a musical sound. Edmund and Eustace would never talk about it afterward. Lucy could only say, 'It would break your heart.' 'Why?' said I. 'Was it so sad?' 'Sad? No,' said Lucy." So there you go. He's saying, "I have spoken to Lucy, and I asked her to describe to me, what do you mean it's sad?" And all she could say was, "No, it wasn't sad, but it broke your heart." And what more can you ask of Lucy? It was something indescribable, and that's the best she could do. But anyway, I love that, again, that implication that not only did these events really happen and Lewis somehow has knowledge of them, he's actually spoken with these characters. He's actually spoken to Lucy.
Did Caspian's abdication come as a surprise to you?
It definitely did.
It did for me.
Yeah, the fact that Caspian, we get there and it just kind of seemed like, okay, they're going to get there. And I guess it's stupid, really. All the weird stuff that's been happening here, it's stupid to say, okay, I know exactly what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. I guess that was a mistake.
Yeah.
But Caspian gets there and basically says, "That's it. I'm going to go with Reepicheep to the world's end." Why do you think Caspian decided to do this? Like, no one else in the crew tries to get in the boat. Why is it Caspian who decides he wants to go with Reepicheep to the world's end?
I think if it weren't for Aslan's rebuke of Caspian, I might think differently. I think it's a bit of a selfish moment.
It definitely is.
And he doesn't know at the time that Eustace and Lucy and Edmund have to stay too. But I think
he senses maybe that's coming.
He might.
Later in the scene, after Aslan's rebuke, Lucy says, you knew we were going to have to go back into our own world sooner or later. And Caspian says, yes, but this
Caspian
is sooner.
Caspian wants, because there's so much of that longing for Aslan's country and this other world, whether it's for visiting our world, he continually has this longing to go to another world.
Yeah, but when they talk about the flat world,
about the round world,
that Lucy and Edmund come from a round world, he's like, "You never told me. I've always wanted to do that." And of course, in the book, Prince Caspian, him having this longing of wanting to, oh, I wish I could have lived in the old days, and I wish I could have lived in old Narnia in the time when the animals could talk.
Caspian's kind of a restless spirit almost at every phase of the Prince Caspian and Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he has something he wants that he can't quite have. It. It's not bad, what he wants, but he's trying to get it. And this is a point where...
longing for something
beyond his
own world.
This is a point where basically he has to learn what the Pevensey children, what the seven friends, have to learn as well. He has to learn you have your own place and your own time that you have to live and dwell and thrive before you can go forward. Likewise, the Pevensey children have to dwell and thrive in our world before they can.
At the end, that's why they're sent back. Yeah.
And so in some ways, Caspian's on a journey not too dissimilar from the Pevensey children, because it's only after all of this he's really ready to go back to Narnia to be king for decades.
Uh-huh.
And... so it seems like he's on a different journey from the Pevensey children, but really,
it's really the same journey.
What they want, Aslan's country is in many ways to him what Narnia is to the Pevensey children, and what they want and what they can't have eventually. You know, he gets a they each get a taste. The Pevensey children get a taste of Narnia. Caspian gets a taste of Aslan's country. He even gets a taste of our world, but that's not where they are supposed to be in the long run, and so they have to. Really no Aslan there in each of their different places, and then at the very end they can all be united together.
I never thought about it that way, of the Pevensey and Caspian kind of having the same journey, and both of them having to learn first I have to thrive in my own world first.
Well, I thought of it
on.
Just now.
Oh, well, great, fantastic.
I really That's did. I because I was thinking just now, I thought, oh my goodness, I think that they're actually on a kind of a similar journey.
This is why I love doing these. This is why I love recording these. But yeah, and that I think maybe that makes him a better king. He's able to go back after mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with the longing he's had. The longing he had when Dr. Cornelius told him stories of old Narnia mm-hmm. and he goes, "Oh, I wish I could have lived in the old days." And now the longing he's feeling to go to ask, he always has this longing for another world. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But I think it's like, look, that you have a job in this world first. Mm-hmm. And one day that longing will be fulfilled.
Yeah.
But not just yet. And of course, and that's one of the reasons I'm so glad Lewis wrote The Silver Chair. Even though he was intended for Dawn Treader to be the last in a trilogy, that in fact that he did go on, because at the end of Silver Chair, ultimately, mm-hmm. we get to see Caspian make it to Aslan's country. Mm-hmm. So it's wonderful that you get to see that. But it in this book, it makes for a really bittersweet ending where he's left. Yeah. And they've come so close to the world's end, and he's left. And in a way, that's us as a reader, because mm-hmm. although we get to read about it, we don't actually get to go there, as amazing as it sounds. Right. I think we're more like Caspian, that we're sort of turned back. We get to kind of hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, I would love to have experienced something like that, as a sort of awe-inspiring and kind of crazy as it was.
Reapy cheeps. Departure.
And we have an emotional goodbye to Caspian, and then the lifeboat across the Silver Sea, mm-hmm. which I'm glad they chose Silver Sea rather than Lily Lake. It's a much cooler name. And then they say goodbye to Reepy Cheep.
What are your thoughts about the significance of this in the story? Or I guess you should say in the Chronicles.
In this story, I love that where it says that Reepy Cheep was trying to be sad for their sake, but he mm-hmm. couldn't help quivering with excitement.
Yeah.
What does it mean to me? Oh, this scene is so powerful. First off, it means Reepy Cheep, who this character we've seen is all about his sword, is all about yep. honor and chivalry and be the last one standing and all that,
mm-hmm.
death and glory charges and all that. And now we see him throwing his sword away.
Yeah.
What a powerful symbol, the fact that I have found something
it's
so much
easy
greater.
For him to throw it away.
I have found a greater adventure than even any of that. And yeah. and I think that when you talk about I really think a lot of this relates to the end of the last battle, where you talk about when we were the reason we liked this Narnia is because it sometimes reminded us of the real Narnia. And so I think when Reepy Cheep was trying to he had these longings for death and glory charges and honor and chivalry and all that. I think he was like, this is what I was really longing for all this time somehow. I don't quite understand how it all fits together, but I think that's what's happening here. We're seeing that longing being... his longing is not being replaced. He's not throwing his sword away and that's it. He doesn't feel that anymore. No, he still has a sense of honor, chivalry, adventure, but he's found... This is not a replacement of that. It's the fulfillment of that.
Right. It reminds me of a great quote by G.K. Chesterton where he says, "The true soldier fights not because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what's behind him." And Reepy Cheep is a soldier who his whole life has loved this, and the time and place demanded his sword before up to this point. And now he doesn't need his sword anymore to continue.
He's somehow able to fulfill that longing without his sword now.
Right. And so it's a beautiful image. And I will say, you know, just of all the different character departures, character deaths, characters leaving stories I've ever read, I can't think of one more beautiful than this one.
In a way, it's such a great send-off for that character, and somehow this captures the theme of the book, and really this, I think, the series as a whole at the same time.
Always sensing
there's something more, and now I found it. We see that theme everywhere throughout the book.
And you know, it would be so easy for Reepy Cheep to be a very two-dimensional, flat glory hound character. Oh yeah, Death and Charge.
In a way, he kind of is, but
he seems
something in me
at first.
But it just touches something in me that I connect with so much.
It's easy for the reader, I think, to just immediately assume. But there's moments like this, moments like where he's at the Aslan's table and his speech there. Moments even with the sea serpent. The moment, all these little, even on the Duffer's Island. Where he says that, yes, Lucy should go and break the spell. Moments like that, you think he really is like a real character who. It just makes him seem more like he really lives and breathes to me. And I think he's really. I know that Puddle Glum is your favorite character, but you have to. This should at least. It should be easier for you
I understand why.
I understand why Reepy Cheep's your favorite character, because Reepy Cheep really is my favorite character.
He's. I thought it was Peter.
Oh, they're kind of tied. for different reasons. I love Peter.
I'll tell you what.
I love Peter and I love Reepy Cheep for different reasons. Kind of.
I'll say every time I read this scene, Reepy Cheep for that moment becomes my favorite character, and this is the.
Fair enough. Really
the moment when he became not just a great character in Narnia, but a fan favorite and something that really. Resonates with people. Lewis has slowly been building him somehow out of what he was in Prince Caspian, which was, a mouse that fights, that's funny. And over the course of Dawn Treader, culminating in this goodbye, he's still a mouse that fights, that's funny, but, oh my gosh, this has so much more emotional resonance and it means something to me. I will say, there's a bit here that I don't think is completely consistent. You can see where Lewis thought this was going to be the last book in a trilogy. But after Reepy Cheep gets in his coracle that they found on Burnt Island, and he disappears over the wave, Lewis writes, "Then it vanished, and since that moment, no one can truly claim to have seen Reepy Cheep the mouse." Which is not exactly true if you read the whole series, because later they do meet Reepy Cheep the mouse.
Well, but is he writing it like at that point in time, if he were to tell all the stories in one day about all these events that happened way back then, and as opposed to this story is finished and now I see what you're saying.
I mean, I don't know, like, as fans, we can always say, well, maybe it meant this, maybe it meant that. And I would never discourage that necessarily, but I think when Lewis wrote that, he was doing it because he was writing this as the last book in a trilogy, which I'm glad it wasn't.
No.
But having said all that, we finally come to one of the most widely discussed scenes in the entire series. We finally see Aslan again, though initially we don't know it's Aslan. It's a lamb. Aslan's already taken the form of an albatross in this book, and now we see him taking the form of a lamb. There's so many parts to this, but basically they say, is there another way can you tell us the way into Aslan's country, from our world? And Aslan says, there's a way into my country from all the worlds. And there's a really specific pattern, I think, that Lewis follows here that makes this scene so heartbreaking, and that's that I guess maybe I should have seen it coming, but I'm assuming they're going to come back at some point and get to Aslan's country, which eventually they will. But right now they're like, when are we going to get back to Narnia? Like me, the reader, just assuming, of course they're going to get back eventually. And then he just drops a bombshell and says, you're never going to come back to Narnia. And they go, no, in despairing voices. And so we're at our all-time low right now. Like, what? You know, all the emotion of coming this close to Aslan's country, and now you're saying not only can we not go there, but we're getting turned away forever? And then he said, and so they're in, just in the moment when they're in their absolute despair, Aslan brings them back up and says, no, there's a way to my country from all the worlds. There I have another name in your world, and you have to learn to know me by that name. And so now we're given hope that I exist in your world.
I think it's
a bittersweet ending, but more sweet than bitter because of that.
This may seem like a really odd thought to have during the scene, but right now my mind goes to Charn. I sometimes think about that because that means that the person of Aslan was in that world too.
Mm-hmm. There's a way into its country from all the worlds.
And somehow there was a way for the people in that world to know him. And again, it's just one of those things.
Well, see, you think about Charn, and absolutely, you can think about all the other pools. Yeah. They see a magician's nephew, and Aslan's somehow part of all that. And what really hit me was our world. And it kind of felt like our world, that pool, the fact that Aslan's talking to us and saying, there's a way into my world, into this world, or there's a way into my country from your world, even. Obviously, with the imagery of a lamb, and Aslan, has been a Christ, like there's been points where he's been a Christ figure up to now, and I think that you could take it as far as you want and say that maybe Lewis is saying that. I won't even say it because I like the fact that Lewis doesn't say it. I like the fact that he makes us go, what does he mean? And makes it a mystery.
But I think it's a mystery.
Whether you realize it or not, it's like Aslan saying, I exist in your world.
But I think it's a mystery revealed to people looking at the story and looking at the meaning of the stories. And I loved it because when I heard that as a kid, the story, I remember one time having a bit of an argument with one of my tutors, and we were arguing over whether a story based on a true event was better than a story completely fictionalized. And I get what he was saying, because he was saying, well, a story that's fiction could be better, a better story, better quality than a narrative of a real incident. And I get that, but I think, maybe I didn't articulate it to him, but what I really need for a story to really resonate with me is I need to feel and see something really true and real in the story.
Truth.
Yeah. I need to see, and this gave the story, all the books, more meaning and elements of truth to me, because Lewis was not looking at the character of Aslan and making him up as he went. What he was writing was already modeled for him elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave it extra, just the whole story's extra power for me in reading them, because, and it could be all kinds of stories. It doesn't have to be, because it doesn't have to be any kind of mirror figure or representation of a real person or place or thing.
Truth is not always best expressed, or truth is surprisingly often best expressed through fantasy, fiction, things that are impossible. And that's the question I think maybe Don Treader, Narnia as a whole kind of leaves me with. Maybe I'd put to our listeners, why do you think that is? Why would it be that there is so much, so many truths in this world that can only seemingly be really captured and expressed through imaginative fiction, fairy tales, fantasy? Why would that be? It's a fascinating question I think about every time I read the Chronicles of Narnia.
I think about it every time I think about fantasy in general, because, you know, Lewis, and again, I think about people who read the wrong kinds of books. I remember one time reading about one historical figure in American history he was known for being a very intelligent man, but he believed in novels and plays and fiction dulled the mind. And I remember the first time I heard that thinking, oh, how wrong he was and what he missed out on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And no better example for me personally is in Chronicles of Narnia. So now we're at the bit you talked about before about them being told they're too old, and basically that they have to start to grow closer to their world first, but this is not goodbye. They will see him again, and of course they do in the last battle. But we're at the end here. I love how... are you ready to talk about the last line in the book, or is there something else you want to talk about?
I'm ready.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and read it?
Shall I read the last paragraph?
Sure.
Okay. Only two more things need to be told. One is that Caspian and his men all came safely back to Ramandu's island, and the three lords woke from their sleep. Caspian married Ramandu's daughter, and they all reached Narnia in the end, and she became a great queen and the mother and grandmother of great kings. The other is that back in our own world, everyone soon started saying how Eustace had improved, and how you'd never know him for the same boy, everyone except Aunt Alberta, who said he'd become very commonplace and tiresome, and it must have been the influence of those Pevensey children.
Well, she's kind of right, you know? I love that bit. And one of the reasons I want to talk about it is Lewis wrote this as the last book in a trilogy. He really thought it was going to be the end. But he did leave an opening, either intentionally or not, an opening in Eustace. And someone even asks Aslan, but what about Eustace? Is he ever going to come back? And of course, Aslan doesn't tell them. But so even though I believe Lewis when he said he intended this to be the last, I do think he intentionally left an opening, a potential for more stories there in Eustace. Maybe it was because he thought, well, just in case I decide to write more. But maybe not, because even at the last battle, he left an opening with Susan. You could still at the end of the last battle say, but what about Susan? And Lewis never went into that. So I just think it just makes the story. I like the fact that it doesn't just end. That there is, even when it ends, but there is still, just because I'm going to stop reading this doesn't mean that the story actually stops.
Well, and the history doesn't stop. I mean, in Lewis's imagination, I'm sure, you know, the world of Narnia continued after, you know, even after the last battle. Well,
gosh, I would have to pick his brain about that. Yeah. All the questions I would ask C.S. Lewis. It very, very good that he did leave an opening in Eustace and something we're going to explore in the next book. Which brings us to a very well-timed book commentary on The Silver Chair, just as the movie is really gearing up. I think this is a great time to start thinking about
it. It really is. And you know what
To me, it's just before all the craziness starts of casting and all the changes they made or whatever.
Casting,
it's like, you know what?
Photos of people playing cricket.
I mean, just before all the craziness of casting rumors and spy pictures and whatever, which is probably still a ways away, but before all that starts, look, let's just talk about, hey, I like this book, well, what do you like so much about it? And just try to, we'll talk about a lot of the details, but also hopefully just touch on, look, just on the most fundamental level, what is it that we like about this book that whatever else they change, they want to be in the movie? So that's something I would invite anyone listening, help us out. You know, send us any questions you may have. You can email me, glumpuddle@narniweb.com, or Rillian, which is rillian@narniweb.com, and give us some guidance on not just a part of the book you might want us to talk about, but also maybe an area that, how are they going to do this in the film? Because there's something, I've been reading Silver Chair recently, and I came across things I never thought about before. I was like, how are they going to do that in the movie? So if you have anything like that, please send it in.
I'm also on Twitter, @prince_rillian. So you can find me there and follow me, and make sure you follow Narnia Web as well.
I'm very much ready to get going with The Silver Chair.
Indeed.
Further up and further in.
Further up and further in.